So Joseph spoke of the path to awakening, and he laid it out very clearly for us last night. And I don't know if you noticed, but a few times he mentioned the factors of awakening leading to awakening. And this is the subject of the talk tonight. They're called the Bojangas in Pali. It's a word I like. And Bo is the root word for Bodhi, which means awake. And Janga is the word for factor. So they're factors of awakening. Sometimes they're called factors of enlightenment. So if you've heard them called this way, it's the same teaching. And actually the word enlightenment has a little bit of a Western culture. It's really, to me, the fact of Bodhi, the root Bodhi, is to be awake. So I'll call them like this tonight. This journey unfolds in a very natural process. There's a very clear sense that these factors of awakening arise through the extreme power of mindfulness. And there's an unfolding which is organic. And actually he expressed this last night as a process to awakening. What is extraordinary is that we see with a little bit of practice, and especially in a retreat setting, that at times, moments, glimpses, when the hindrances are not present, right? The difficult forces of desire, aversion, sloth and torpor, agitation or restlessness and doubt are simply absent, right? I'm sure that you've had all moments today where these were not present. And what happens is that the hindrances begin to weaken. And what happens when the hindrances begin to weaken? They fade away and we start to taste the beautiful qualities of heart and mind. Through the power of mindfulness. And so this is why the Buddha really laid it out as a map of the journey. And you know, there's so many lists from these teachings, and it's to memorize them. You have to really remember that these were oral teachings, so it was easy for memorization. And I think that one of the lists, and it said that the most important list, actually, is the list of the seven factors of awakening. At least I see it this way. Because they are the powerful qualities of heart and mind that lead all the way to the end of suffering, but they're also extremely helpful. They serve us in our life and on our path to the end. So they become our great friends on the journey. And what they do is that the more they're present, the less the hindrances are present, which means that in the Buddhist teachings, there's a way that it's very clearly stated that we feed the factors of awakening, and very naturally, there's a starving or a weakening, kind of a starving of the hindrances. So these really balance the mind and heart in a very, very wholesome way. The Buddha expresses this. He says, they lead to awakening. Therefore, they are called the factors of awakening. So direct, so simple. So they become our allies, right? Sometimes you see the hindrances stated as the poisons, the enemies, the unwholesome factors. I mean, really kind of the bad guys. And here we have allies, so the factors of awakening are really to be considered like friends on the path. They're very, very positive qualities wholesome states of mind, and it said that these are the states of mind that are present in one who is awake. But as we walk on the path, we can sense these moments, glimpses, and they give a lot of trust, and they also encourage us to continue to walk on the path. And that's what's so nice. So what are they? If we've never heard of these factors of awakening, of course there's mindfulness. Mindfulness is the first of these factors of awakening, standing on its own. Then there are three arousing or energizing factors, which are investigation. Then there's energy or effort. And the third energizing factor is rapture, or what Joseph called intense interest. Some people like to call it joyful interest. Then there are three stabilizing or tranquilizing factors, which are calm, then concentration, and equanimity. So mindfulness is the first factor, and it begins the journey. There's no doubt. Nothing really happens without mindfulness. But it's also the one that will help balance the other six factors. Helps balance in relationship to energy, the calming and the energizing. So mindfulness has that job. There's a balancing act between bringing energy up when needed and bringing the energy to a calm when needed, right? So there's a real sense of balance. And what is the purpose of this? Well, a mind that has energy and peace is ripe for insight, for seeing into the nature of phenomena, whether body or mental phenomena. And these qualities grow, and it's said that they mature, and when they mature into release. Release meaning release from suffering. So at the beginning of our practice, we really don't notice these qualities. There's no doubt that they're well hidden, but they're here. They're present. So it's very helpful to have an appreciation and an understanding that these qualities are already present within us. They're simply covered over by the hindrances. When the hindrances are weakened, these states of mind arise very naturally and they grow stronger. When they mature, their result is freedom. So here again, these mental factors, states of mind, will grow according to causes and conditions, right? They're not personal in any way. They don't arise by the force of will. It's having mindfulness as a foundation. Very naturally, these can flourish. So there's an intention, and the intention is to pay attention. Now they will ripen, each one of them at different times, one nourishing the other, but of course they also manifest together as a unified element, right? So it's important to understand that it's not that we fully cultivate one and then we move on to the next one, and then to the next one, right? They support each other. So there is a sequence, and I will speak of each one in a while. But there's also a clear sense of a circle, right? They support each other in a circular manner. They appear in the fourth foundation of mindfulness that Stephen spoke about two nights ago. If you remember, he just mentioned them since he knew that there was going to be this talk. And there was the five aggregates, the four noble truths, right? The five hindrances are in this fourth foundation. So they appear alongside, and you have to understand them as exactly in the way that Stephen spoke the other night. So a meditator, a practitioner, learns to know and understand about these factors, when they are present, when they are absent, how to strengthen them, how to cultivate them. And this is done through the power of mindfulness. This is why they're, in a way, included in the foundation of mindfulness, four foundations, as I will be reading to you now. This is the Buddha. Bhikkhus, meaning monks, but practitioners, definitely you're practitioners here on retreat, so please consider yourself that the Buddha is addressing to you. On whatever occasion, a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as body, feelings as feelings, feeling tone, mind as mind, mind objects as mind objects, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away desire and sorrow for the world. On that occasion, unremitting mindfulness is established in him. Abiding thus mindful, he investigates and examines that state with wisdom and embarks upon a full inquiry into it. In one who investigates and examines that state with wisdom and embarks upon a full inquiry into it, energy is aroused. In one who has aroused energy, rapture arises. In one who is rapturous, the body and the mind become tranquil. In one whose body is tranquil and who feels pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated. He closely looks on with equanimity at the mind thus concentrated. This is how the four foundations of mindfulness, developed and cultivated, fulfill the seven factors of awakening. So you really have a sense of progression, right? And what is interesting is when we wish to have concentration, it's not by will, by striving, but it is by feeling pleasure, gladness, the mind stable and relaxed, alert and tranquil, that the concentration factor can grow and deepen. So this is an important point, actually. It's said in Asia, and I've heard this many times in Burma when I was being given a talk on the seven factors of awakening, that the celestial beings, called the devas, often come and visit the places when this teaching is offered, because they rejoice in the fact that the humans, us, can hear about these beautiful qualities of heart and mind, because they're so special. So you may want to look for the devas tonight. They might be around. So I'll be talking a little bit about each one and how they support each other and how they grow. Just, you know, of course, one could give an hour talk on each of these. Yeah, we're very clear at this, but an overview. So, beginning by mindfulness. As we know, it's about the present moment awareness. Right? This is something which we understand. Being aware of each experience when it is happening. Right? Breathing, knowing that we're breathing. And this is quite special because usually we don't know. So we know what is going on when it is going on. And as you know, it's not so easy to do this training. It really requires some work, some intention, some motivation. But mindfulness comes along and it acts like a mirror that reflects just what is. There is no interference. So we pay attention, and in a way there's no preference when mindfulness is in the mind. It can see clearly as much an unwholesome factor, such as greed or aversion, or a wholesome factor, and not get caught or drown or push away. It just sees what is. So it's a very clear, pure kind of attention. This is why it's called a factor of mind which is very supportive. Usually we get involved when greed is present or aversion is present, but with practice, there's less likely to be reactivity. And when we are practicing, there's a greater willingness to stay with what is, no matter what it is that is manifesting. Now it's said, out of all these factors, that it's the factor of mind, mindfulness, that we can never have too much of. Which means that maybe the other factors, some of them, there can be too much. There can be an excess or a lack, right? So you can rely on mindfulness. You can really trust this quality in every occasion. Don't doubt about mindfulness. And I know in my early practice, I would often doubt about myself being able to be aware, and my teacher Sayadaw Pandita would constantly have an encouragement from his way of saying, you don't need to do anything. Trust mindfulness. Mindfulness is your guide. And it was very, very important, actually, on my path, that I didn't need to interfere. We so often think we need to interfere, do more. And if we allow this very clear sense of connection, mindfulness becomes more frequent in the mind, and it steadies us in the practice. And I'm sure by today that you've seen this moment, right? From mindfulness, there's a natural organic way that it engages us in a different way, which leads to the second factor of mind, investigation. Now, investigation is very interesting, and many of you, at least that I've seen, have asked about this quality of mind. What does it mean? Often misunderstood. The second factor springs forth from a heart and mind that is interested. So this definition is a little bit confusing. It's Dhammavichaya, if you're interested in the Pali, which means investigation of phenomena. And when we hear, at least when I heard the word investigation, I thought analyzing, right? Thinking about a conceptual examination, which it isn't at all. Here we don't use concept. It's out of a non-conceptual awareness that investigation is happening. So it draws the attention closer to the experience. When we speak about penetrative awareness, non-superficiality, this is the factor which is increasing. It's an intimacy of contact with whatever experience is manifest. So mindfulness is coupled with investigation, penetrating, and this has been mentioned on this course, non-superficial. And this enables us to see clearly. See what clearly? Well, the nature of mind and body. Instead of pain, we see hardness, softness, right? Even in sync with body sensation. So it's also called the wisdom factor. And in that word, there's often the word connected, which is, of course, clear seeing, right? Seeing the nature of things. And there's another expression, which is wise attention. That quality of mindfulness with investigation is equivalent, at least the way I understand it, to wise attention, which in Pali is called yoniso manasikara. Have you heard that term? Yeah, well, some of you have. So manasikara is attention, and yoniso has the root word of yoni. And yoni means womb. You know that word? Yes, the womb. So it's quite fascinating because it's a womb-like attention, which means there's the image of embracing, nurturing, caring, really being very close, right? The connection. Womb-like attention. So intimate. And the care. This is why so often when we speak of careful attention or caring attention, an attention which is holding a nourishment, nurture, it's that quality of gentleness, softness. So we investigate with that type of attitude in the mind. So this may be helpful as an image, that there's an embracement. Now, this factor of mind can be strengthened very directly. We can work on it. How can we work and strengthen investigation? Well, for example, so often we begin with having an image of the breath, right? So we're at a distance, image of the body. And slowly, slowly, we begin to sense and feel the breath, right? As an experience of touch. And we can even come closer into contact, and this is just an example, right, that I'm taking with the breath. This can happen with any experience. But if we take the breath, for example, we will be noticing the beginning of an in-breath, the middle of an in-breath, and the end of an in-breath, in the same way with the out-breath. So there's a close connection, and this reinforces the contact. So this contact is reinforced, and we see clearly the nature of sensation in this case. Sayadaw Upandita, he was one of my main teachers, so this is why I speak of him so much. He would ask me and other yogis in an interview to notice three distinct types of sensation for one in-breath. That's a lot. You know, you can say, okay, vibration, and then you really needed to look, because the point was that in the next interview, you were supposed to report those sensations. What did you find? And I would assure you that he would ask. So inviting the yogis to look more closely, and not just to, you know, to burden the yogi and say, well, why does he want us to do that? It's to sharpen the wisdom factor, to really sharpen the mind like you would sharpen a knife, right? And there's a sense of contact. And then in the next interview, he would come and he would ask, okay, now one more. And then I would do good in the sitting, but then my walking was not so. It was just like walking. So he would say, okay, 10 sensations when you touch the sole of the foot on the ground. And this would be just for some time, just to sharpen the quality of the wisdom. Then he'd give us another task to do. So just for some time, because the investigation factor needed some sharpening. So this is really something that you can include in your practice should you wish to. come closer into contact with what is happening. Now, the objects, they will come and go, right? I mean, it's not about keeping a sensation and keeping an experience. The objects come and go. It's not about the objects. What it's about, it's the wisdom. The wisdom grows in the mind. And so we learn how to activate it, how to support it. And what we see is the change, exactly what we've been talking about, changing sensations, impermanence. The seeing the change, it's unsatisfactory, yet it's not personal, right? So this whole process works out of conditions that constantly arise and pass, but this is a living experience when we're so close to be with ourselves in this way. So we have a sense of knowing which direction to go to free the mind from suffering. There's a sense that we're motivated, and glimpses of truth bring up the next factor, which naturally comes up from this waking up of seeing the way things are, which is called energy or virya, right? Now, virya has many translations. It's called effort. It's called energy. Some people like to call it energizing effort. So they contract the two words. Some speak of courage. There's kind of this sense of putting courage into it. I like the word enthusiasm, because it really is a mental energy. So it has this quality of being interested. And because there is a motivation, we apply it and we pick up this energy from a place which is wholesome and not from a place of striving. So I think we need the translation for enthusiasm. Can you? Good. It refreshes the mind. Now, like for anything in our life, nothing happens without this quality, right? And here too, in practice, it's essential that we have it, a certain kind of effort. And yet, I find that it's the factor of mine which is the most difficult to find out about, because, you know, the circumstances and the situations, they change all the time. So it's through excess energy or effort, or lack of effort and energy, that we will learn how much. And it's a constant adjustment. So you have to give up the idea that you need to find a state, and that state you're going to have forever, because it's not about that, right? So the way that we can really bring a quality of appropriate energy is by mindfulness, once again, because mindfulness will be the balancing factor in relationship to this specific quality. Too much effort, we tighten up. Too little effort, we're lax, right? So it really requires a balance. Now, one indication here, which is very helpful, I find, is because of the tendency to grasp and to crave, we often want to see what's not here. We look for something and want something which is not present, right? That's the kind of leaning forward which craving brings about. But in this practice, we understand that the learning and the freedom comes from being with what is here. And in this way, the phrase of Joseph, "It's already here," is this indication. And you can really use this phrase of in relationship to effort. It's already here. We're meeting what is. And this greatly simplifies our task in relationship to effort. To know that we need to check our attitude. And in this way, effort will build the energy. So it's effort that builds energy, as was said earlier. And how do we build that energy? It's through a continuity of attention. It's kind of the only way, actually. Sustained perseverance born out of an interest, mindfulness, and curiosity. So this is something which takes time, because it's so easy to overlook this. You know, we make extra effort in the sitting practice, for example, if we're a sitter, or if we're a walker. There's some people who like sitting more than walking, and others walking more than sitting. So there's a tendency, right, that we're making really a good amount of effort for one, and then we think we've done our job. And yet, it's really important that we do kind of, you know, the effort where it sustains us. But it's also important to not overlook the many ways that we take breaks, creating gaps in the field of mindfulness. And gaps in the field of mindfulness, it doesn't mean not looking at a bird. It doesn't mean not looking at a beautiful flower. You know, like, oh my gosh, I've lost my mindfulness. You know? I really need to be aware of my feet touching the ground. Then you're again in striving. It means just as you're looking at the flower, as you're taking the cup, there's a sense of steadiness which mindfulness will bring you. That you're there present for what you're doing, what you're seeing, what you're tasting. So this is filling in the gap. So it's more this attitude of caring, the womb-like attention, the caring all through the day, just a very natural way that we practice. And actually, what is extraordinary is that it brings ease in the practice. We think that every time we give ourselves a break, it's going to be easier. Well, it's exactly the reverse. If you really kind of completely check out, it's so much harder to have the energy to begin again. And every check out is a sense of feeling discouraged. So it's not about striving and really being forceful, willful. In a very gentle way, keep going gently, persistently, with constancy, and we will have gaps in the mindfulness. It's not about not having gaps in the mindfulness. We will have gaps, but then it's just to bring it back very naturally, nicely. Now, this energy is something of an art. It really is the quality of a dancer, an art, a creative sense of energy, nourished by motivation and interest. Much more than the energy to accomplish something, right? Not kind of the heroic where you push yourself forward. And so this is what we're learning. But when there is this quality of energy and also flexibility in the mind, then we find the next factor, which comes from a sense of connection. And the third arousing factor is called rapture. You know this word, rapture? Mm-hmm. No? It's okay. Intense interest. It's also, you can name it also a kind of delight. There's a sense of joy, right? I'll be giving a few definitions here. because of the mindfulness and we're closely in contact with what is happening, there's energy in the mind. The mind is steady. It stays with whatever is present. The mind in itself feels an intense interest with what is happening. And therefore, there's a certain kind of delight that comes only by being in contact and not needing to run away, regardless of what is being experienced. And that's what's so great. We can be really in the presence of very unpleasant sensation, and this can happen. So there's an enthusiasm that comes due to the intimacy with the experience, and it brings up joy. This is why it's also called joyful interest. And what is happening then? Well, there's a sense of ease in the practice. And dare I say, even pleasure, which comes about, which is not based in sense pleasure. And so it's a pleasure that comes about with the spiritual qualities that are present and that are growing. And sometimes it really comes as a surprise for us, right? Because there's simply no reactions in the mind. We're stable. And we just delight in whatever it is that is happening. And we say, wow, after all, this practice is working at times. So there's a kind of groove from that positive energy. There's a kind of uplifting, and we are even called to practice even a little more and give some sense of interest. The mind is more steady and pliable for a while. Now, all of this is momentary, right? We, of course, a few maybe moments later, drown into a mind state that is difficult, but it's okay. See, this is how it happens, right? It's not done for once. So rapture manifests in different ways. It's a sense of lightness in the mind of body, in the mind or body. It comes in waves sometimes. Sometimes it can be really strong. There's a sense of uplifting and we feel really light. Sometimes we don't feel the body at all. And it feels like floaty. And sometimes it's like a shower of energy. This has to do with energy, okay? So different kinds of raptures, which I won't go into tonight, but there are five kinds of different raptures. Sometimes it's really pleasant, and so we get attached to that. Sometimes it's not so pleasant because of the intensity, right? So it can be like some itchiness under the skin or too much heat, often too much heat. Like if you feel, oh, you're so warm, that can be the quality of rapture. Now, as every single factor, this quality will come and go. It's not to be taken personally. But with a steadiness of attention, rapture very, very clearly helps us stay uplifted. If it's in excess, it can lead to agitation, which is, of course, the hindrance, right? So it's so easy to see how these factors of awakening can very easily fall in with the imbalance of energy into a hindrance. And it happens. So how do I rebalance my energy? Mindfulness. Mindfulness does the job. I tell you, you can trust it. So now these are the three energizing factors that I described, right? They are balanced with the three calming, or sometimes called pacifying, factors. And they work, so there's really this sense of balancing. stabilizing factor, sometimes also called. So the first one, which naturally grows if there's a good sense of heightened interest coming from mindfulness, investigation, energy, and joyful interest, there's a very clear sense that the energy drops a little bit. The mind is very steady. It's pliable. And we notice the next factor, which is calm. Some people like to call it tranquility. So the first three help the mind get activated. If there's too much sluggishness or dullness, then they help. We can really heighten these qualities, especially if there's sleepiness. The last three will help the mind rest and relax if there's too much agitation, excess of energy. Now, we do not figure this out, right? It's very important that we understand that this happens through a living process in relationship to intuitive awareness, right? So calm. Calm comes when we just stay present. And that quality of sustained attention will naturally lead to a greater sense of calm. And I don't know if you notice, but if you look around and you think of us on the first day and how we are now, there's no doubt that even if internally, you know, there's a sense of often agitation and, you know, maybe some excitement or even impatience, we can't evaluate the degree of calm that has grown. And it's there. So there's no doubt that this is nourished. So the calm modulates also the rapture when it is too strong through the power of mindfulness. It's the example that is given is that it is like the cool shade of a tree to a person who has been in the hot sun. It's very nice, this image. Now, often the feeling tone here is neutral. And this is why we invite you to really taste the neutral. And we're not so used to that. We're so drawn to pleasant and unpleasant that we disconnect when neutral is here, trying to find something else to entertain us. But here with calm, it's great because it can really lead us to stay connected, right? And so there's less likely a sense of wanting pleasure, excess in the pleasantness. So when calms come, we often miss it. So work with calm. Look if it's present. And especially if calm is present, allow it to nourish your practice. Often we miss it because we're not acquainted to it. And, it, you know, we're taken aback. This is when we say, oh, it's so boring. Nothing is happening in my practice, right? Or we say, okay, now what? What should I do, you know, to get a little bit more entertained and excitement? Appreciate the calm. So we oversee the neutral quality of this experience, and yet we need to stay interested. It strengthens and deepens the relationship for further progress on the path. Ajahn Chah says this, try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become still in any surroundings, like a clear forest pool. All kinds of wonderful rare animals will come to drink at the pool, and you will clearly see the nature of things. You will see many strange and wonderful things come and go, but you will be still. So this quality of stillness is an important one. Can we invite it and honor it when it's here? So much of our practice comes to a standstill because we don't honor this specific quality when it's present, thinking that something is missing. So often, you know, the yogis in an interview say, but nothing is happening. You know, there's really, and there's a distancing and boredom. I say, no, your practice is fine. This is calm. Appreciate the calm. You're sitting under a tree in the shade, the heart and mind are stilled with the possibility of comfort. There's ease in the body in those moments. And so don't invite boredom. It's a distancing away. Boredom is a type of reversion where there's a distancing. It's not needed. So we can stay steady in this quality of calm, which naturally flourishes into this state of concentration, which is the next factor, samadhi. This is all natural. It's kind of flourishing by itself. And if you had some practice, there's no doubt you know about this, right? So samadhi means collectedness of mind. There's a gathered energy, and that energy is kind of settled. It's collected. So it's not concentration like forceful, like, you know, frozen orange juice, which is hard. You know, often we have kind of an image of concentration like it should be rigid and hard. This is tightness. It's gathered energy. There's a sense of connection. The awareness is steady. And we can see things arise and pass with a greater clarity. Now, it's the mindfulness that is steadying. It's not about a specific object. There's a changing flow of sensations, of experiences. It's the attention that is steadying. So often we try to hold on, you know, when we work with concentration, think that we should hold on to a specific object. And that's very common, actually. The strength here is that we can notice, that we can see that the quality of steadiness of mind can grow with changing objects. Concentration has two benefits. It gives a sense of rest, well-being, where less likely to be burdened by the hindrances. Actually, when concentration, the mind is gathered and the energy is strong, it's said that the hindrances really have not much chance to come and visit. These visiting forces that are not so appreciated. So this is one benefit. And the second benefit is there's a quality of stillness which allows insight to arise. The mind is composed. And I really like this word, composed. There's a sense of seeing into the nature and not being thrown. So we can choose to energize the practice at times by narrowing down the field of awareness to recollect the attention, as we've been invited to do, right? We can have, remember, open awareness, or a sense that the awareness can be a little more, the mindfulness can be a little more narrow. And this may be helpful at times. It's been extremely helpful for me to just gather the energy, collect it, and just stay with one experience. As a base, it's just non-scatteredness, right? Non-distraction. That's what concentration is. But we need to be fully aware that we're not meditating for concentration alone. You know, so many people think, oh, they come and they say, I don't have concentration, or I want more concentration. Concentration is a support for wisdom. Right? So mindfulness and concentration are a support for wisdom. We meditate for liberation. And it's easy to want to grasp at the wish to have more concentration, or when it's here, get attached to it. And there we're stuck. And I like Ajahn Chah's words. He says, normally, the untrained mind is full of worries and anxieties. So when a bit of concentration arises in practice, you easily become attached to it, mistaking states of tranquility for the end of meditation. Sometimes you may even think you have put an end to lust, greed, or hatred, only to be overwhelmed by them later on. Actually, it is worse to be caught in calmness than to be stuck in agitation, because at least you will want to escape from agitation, whereas you are content to just remain in calmness and not go any further. When extraordinary, clear, blissful states arise from insight practice, they are to be known, not to be clung to. Although this tranquility has a sweet taste, it too must be seen as impermanent, unsatisfactory, and empty. Practice without thought of attaining any special state. Just know whether the mind is calm, concentrated, or not. And if so, whether a little or a lot. In this way, it will develop on its own. To concentrate is like turning on the switch, and wisdom is the resulting light. Isn't that beautiful? Mm-hmm. Turning on the switch, and wisdom is the resulting light. Without the switch, there is no light. But we should not waste our time playing with the switch. Likewise, concentration is the empty bowl, and wisdom is the food that fills it and makes the meal. This is from Ajahn Chah. So we understand, right, with this very clear explanation, the beautiful qualities of heart and mind that are bringing the extremely favorable conditions for the mind to move into liberation. Seeing clearly, the wisdom that reveals freedom from grasping. Equanimity is the last of these factors, and it's born and results in being able to be with all of experience without getting knocked over. It is the last factor, and it is the factor that is culminating into a state where, whether experiences are pleasant or unpleasant, the mind doesn't reach out. It doesn't lean forward or pull away. It's stable in the presence of whatever it is that may manifest. Now, this results from the culmination of the previous qualities, right? And when at times we're really enabling this quality of equanimity to be present, there's a great feeling of balance. And we've all had, again, this quality manifest, at least glimpses of it. We can say that equanimity is the momentary cessation of reactivity in the mind, right? And it's said that it's the quality, actually, that is present in one who has awakened, this quality of equanimity. Yet it's still conditioned. Now, equanimity is the ground for liberation to arise. There's wisdom, there's concentration, there's all the wholesome factors of awakening that are in full force and that function. There's no lack. There's no excess. There's simply a very clear balance in those moments. And it is in this state that we are enabling the capacity to free the mind from suffering. We find that there's great ease, and the process itself makes us understand more and more deeply that ultimately it is not by grasping or pushing away that we will be free, but by allowing ourselves to deeply feel the letting go. And equanimity is the factor of mind that helps us and that eases us the ability to let go of our attachments. So it's the culmination of the factors of awakening. Now, when all of these are brought together, the mind has a sense simply of alertness. There's alertness, there's a brightness, and yet there's a lot of stillness. Right? So at times, it can really feel like that, like it's the word for equanimity is equipoise. Right? It's just simply the absence of reactivity, actually. There's receptivity, openness, and no grasping, no clinging. So it serves not only as the end to the path, but it serves us in our life as a whole. What we're doing here serves also our daily life. I think it's so important to understand that, of course, we're speaking here of a progress of insight, a process which will unfold and will take some time. But every effort, every way that you are putting yourself into the practice naturally will give you a sense of greater ease, peace, equanimity, well-being, calm, steadiness, trust, and all the qualities that nourish a sense of freedom in our life. So we practice for this life. I'd like to end with a quote from the Buddha. He says, "Bhikkhus, the seven factors of awakening, when developed and cultivated, lead to peace, to direct knowledge, to awakening, to nibbana. They are noble and emancipating. They lead the one who acts upon them to the end of suffering." It's very, very clear, right? So how can we see? We can really sense in our practice when they're present. You can take a look and recognize them. In the same way that we ask you to recognize the hindrances, recognize if the factors of awakening are present. If there's calm, if there's a sense of investigation, energy, joy, because of the connection. And you can further notice that by sustaining the attention, they grow. It really is like the weeds in the garden and the beautiful flowers, right? The weeds kind of tend to not be present so much, and the beautiful flowers just grow. Okay, so we'll sit just for a few seconds together, just to sense the beautiful quality of silence, calm presence, this moment.